Nearly four decades ago, a peanut farmer from Georgia became America's 39th president. This hour, a look back at Jimmy Carter's presidency and Jimmy Carter the man. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, taking a break from our coverage of the 2016 presidential race to look back at the national political climate some 40 years ago that led to the election of Jimmy Carter. Joining us this hour with their reflections and analysis, Jim McCormick and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. Also, Iowa Public Radio's own Dean Bork, who covered the rise of Jimmy Carter here in Iowa. Do you have a personal experience or reflection from the Carter years that stands out in your memory? Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And that does it. Carter is the winner with 272 electoral votes.
Nearly four decades ago, a peanut farmer from rural Georgia became America's 39th president. This hour, we're taking a break from the coverage of the 2016 presidential election cycle to recall an election cycle and a presidency some four decades ago. We'll look back at the presidency of James Earl Carter. We'll look also at how the Iowa caucuses figured into his successful campaign, and also then later the successes and failures of his administration and the work he did after stepping down as president. Joining us to do that in our Ames studio, Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hello, Stefan.
Hi.
Jim McCormick is with us as well, professor of political science at ISU. Jim, great to have both of you in our studio.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Dean Bork is in our Iowa City studio, Iowa Public Radio correspondent and longtime host of Iowa Press on IPTV. We'll get to that a little bit later. Dean, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben, Jim, and Stefan.
Well, let's get your early reflections on this. We're asking you to think back four decades. Let's start with you, Stefan. When do you first remember hearing of this man, Jimmy Carter, entering the political fray in the mid-1970s?
Well, he's, of course, began to show some interest in Iowa with all of the others. Was unknown. And one weekend in the middle of the summer, I was out at a friend's farm in Story County, and we were grilling out and having some beer, and it was very hot. And this farm is set way back from the paved road, and there's a row of trees. And all of a sudden, a group of people appeared on the paved road and came down the farm lane towards us and stopped and got off their bicycles. And this gentleman came up and said, "Hi, my name is Jimmy Carter." And I had heard the name, but, you know, we didn't know much about him. And he was very friendly and polite and shook hands, and he had a couple of staff with him and his wife with him, and said, "I'm running for president," and he gave us a little handout and got back on the bicycle, and they went back down the lane and then continued to the next farmstead. And I think the reason I'm telling this little story is because that was sort of an unusual sudden occurrence, and he did use bicycles and did kind of trundled through many counties in Iowa, just showing up and shaking hands with people. And that was when he sort of went from being Jimmy Who to being Jimmy Carter, and then people began to pay more attention to him.
Jim McCormick, wow, that's a story from Stefan there. Can you top that or match that? Jimmy Carter on a bike, biking up to your summer gathering.
I can't really top that at all. I can tell you that, I had just moved to Iowa then and was experiencing the Iowa caucuses for the first time. So this was quite surprising to see this, peanut farmer, as they kept describing him, from Georgia, participating against, like Mo Udall was the other, prominent kind of candidate at that particular time. And so that was sort of my introduction to Jimmy Carter through the caucus process.
Dean Bork, you covered the 1976 election here in Iowa. In fact, you hosted then as now Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press. You actually had Jimmy Carter on that program that you hosted in the mid-1970s. Well, what did you think the first time you heard of him?
I'm fascinated by Stefan's story because that's exactly, I mean, Stefan doesn't seem to be overly impressed by a guy who stopped by on a bicycle and stopped by to shake hands and went on his way. But that's kind of the way it was with having him on Iowa Press. I was not enamored or impressed by the fact that here's a really obscure governor of Georgia here in Iowa, and we're scheduling him to be on Iowa Press. And so, you know, it was fine, but I didn't think, I thought this was the last we're going to see of this fellow.
Mm-hmm.
But we now at Iowa Public Television sort of, in a way, take some of the credit. Now, Jimmy Carter deserves all of the credit, of course, but take some of the credit for giving him some credibility in his campaign so that when he biked up to Stefan, Stefan might have seen this fellow having been on this statewide program at that time.
Mm-hmm. We want to reach out to our listeners, too, because we know there are listeners who remember the Carter years, perhaps remember the Carter campaign, perhaps Jimmy Carter bicycled up to you at some point in the mid-1970s or shook your hand. Would you like to tell us about it? A personal experience, a reflection from the Carter years or the Carter campaign. What stands out in your memory? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's set the scene here because we have to get the context here to understand the rise of Jimmy Carter. And I'd like to have you comment about that. We have Nixon resigning in disgrace after the Watergate scandal in 1973. We're right in the post-Vietnam era, the U.S. Pulling its troops out of Vietnam after a long battle there, war, licking its wounds as a nation. I wonder if you, Stefan, can describe the mood of the nation at that time, a very dark period in American politics and for the American psyche.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and you've set it up very, very nicely because, you know, the one thing that Jimmy Carter came across as being was a kind of a very genuine person, fairly smart individual, not someone who had a lot of ego on his shoulder, very different from some of the contenders that followed him. And I think it was refreshing to see that. It was also, I'm reminded, the desire to find someone who was not sort of a Washington inside politician. And that theme has reverberated in other years in the U.S. as well. And I think people felt that they wanted to take another look at him and see if maybe he could help bridge those painful years and that disappointment, especially in Nixon and the Watergate scandal. And I think over time, slowly as he went around the state and he campaigned, I think, if I recall, really mostly focusing on blue-collar workers and farmers. Whereas I think Mo Udall really hit the labor unions very hard. You have to remember that in that period of time, labor unions were really powerful and still had a huge amount of clout in the Democratic Party. And so he went and basically did the retail politics and I think he sold himself and gathered support as the months went on.
This is Dean Borg, Stefan and Jim. Don't you think, too, that the Iowa caucuses, we have to put it in context, the Iowa caucuses did not at that time have the prominence that they do now. Jimmy Carter wasn't getting the kind of coverage that is inherent in the Iowa caucuses now.
Yeah, I think that the Iowa caucuses really took off with, actually Jimmy Carter didn't win the Iowa caucuses. He actually became in second to undecided. But what it did was it propelled him, but it also propelled the Iowa caucus process because at this time, the Republicans, of course, were not in this kind of same caucus arrangement, and that really comes in 1980. So I think it had a double effect in terms of helping Jimmy Carter in terms of his exposure and so on, and then also the Iowa caucus process.
When you do look at the Iowa caucus results, it's interesting. Was it undecided? What was the column that actually won? No candidate, right, Jim?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
But Carter,
37% was uncommitted, as they said, and Carter at 27%.
So. 27%, but yeah. I'm looking at the vote tally, just over nearly 11,000 votes coming in second, Birch Bayh, senator from Indiana, and then Mo Udall, who was thought to be strong at the beginning, a big national figure, fifth place, only 6% in this. So this is a huge upset, and then this sets off the media swarm to discover more about who is this Georgia peanut farmer. Of course, he became state senator or a senator and then governor there as well. Let's listen, now that we've set the context here and if sort of recalling that dark mood in the early 1970s, let's get a taste of a Jimmy Carter TV ad from 1976 from this campaign. And we can hear not only how refreshing it would have been to the ears of Americans in the mid-70s, but also, and I think you'll agree with me, connections with our present time. A Jimmy Carter ad from 1976 campaign.
We've seen walls built around Washington, and we feel like we can't quite get through to guarantee the people of this country a government that's sensitive to our needs, that we can understand and control, that's competent, well-managed, efficient, economical, purposeful, and also a government of which we can be proud.
Jimmy Carter, a leader for a change.
Now, Stefan, if that doesn't ring through the decades into the present, I don't know what does.
Well, that's right. You hear the same message repeated and maybe a little more harshly than Carter. Carter was kind of a fairly gentle individual, but he certainly sort of came in as the refreshing individual from, you know, Georgia and someone who was a nuclear scientist and had served in the Navy and so on. So he had these credentials that eventually unfolded as you peeled away the layers of that onion. And as they peeled them away, people saw things that they kind of liked. I must add, however, there was also something about him that Democrats were somewhat worried about, and that was the fact that he was a born-again Christian. Mm-hmm. I remember very, very clearly going to a house of a very prominent Democrat who had gathered a bunch of people to talk about which candidate to support. And many of the people were very concerned about having a born-again Southern individual running and what he would do in terms of women's rights and other things. And so a lot of them were nervous about Jimmy Carter, and I think we need to acknowledge that as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that Jimmy Carter, the first born-again Christian who became president, now we mostly connect evangelical Christians with the Republican Party. When did that switch take place?
McCormick can answer that one.
Do you know, Jim? Does anybody know here at our team?
Well, I think, if you think of the caucuses of 1988, I think would be kind of a turning point when, evangelical minister actually won the Iowa caucuses. I think that's when, where you really tapped into at least in Iowa, the evangelical movement in terms of presidential politics and on the Republican side.
Jim McCormick with us, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, Dean Borg with us of Iowa Public Radio and IPTV. Mm-hmm. We're recalling the Carter years. What do you remember from those years, an experience or reflection? 1977 to 1981, he was a president, has done many, many things in the post-presidency period of his life. Let's go to Susan in Algona. Susan dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hello, Susan. What does this spark in your memory?
Oh, I remember it with very fond memories. I was a freshman at Iowa State University, and all of the presidential candidates came to our wonderful student union. And we went around, they were in a big area, and I met, President Carter, Birch Bayh, Morse Udall, and I think Harris from Oklahoma, I can't remember his first name. President Carter was giving out free peanuts, so we shook hands with all these candidates, and it was just a wonderful experience.
Uh-huh. So you know, the press always describes him as a peanut farmer from Georgia, but he was giving out peanuts. He was playing this up.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what were you? What stood out for you about meeting Jimmy Carter there? Did you see a future president, or was he just this modest, nice man from Georgia?
Modest, nice man from Georgia. In fact, I remember telling my roommate that he seemed like a minister, and his wife, they reminded me of a missionary. They were just so obviously humble, even then. And I was leery of him. You know, I didn't know his whole background yet because he was from the South and the governor. I wasn't sure of his intentions. And so I was for Morris Udall. I was for definitely. And I went on to the caucus and supported Mo Udall. But, of course, he wasn't viable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Susan from Algona.
I fully supported Jimmy Carter when he got the nomination. I've read both of his books. I very much admire him, and I think he had a good presidency.
Susan from Algona, thank you for your thoughts and your memories from the Carter years. 1-866-780-9100. Dean Borg. Well, let's go to recall the election. He did win the election of 1976 against the incumbent, Gerald Ford. Who can tell us about that?
Well, there was a bit of animosity. Maybe not animosity isn't the word, but as Stefan or Jim have described it, there was a dissatisfaction with the Washington establishment. Mm-hmm. And that was personified, I think, in Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon. And so that worked against Gerald Ford. I'd be interested to see what Stefan and Jim think about that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that essentially Ford was seen as, you know, part of the Nixon problem and the Nixon, you know, scandal. And the pardon didn't help him much, but he was part of that administration and, you know, was essentially painted with the brush of not having kept an eye on what Tricky Dick was doing. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that helped a lot to get Jimmy Carter to become the candidate of independent voters in the general election.
Right. Even in my memory, as a teenager during the Carter years, I remember a bumper sticker during this campaign, Nixon is trying to sell us a used Ford.
Mm. That's right. That's good. Yeah.
I think the Ford pardon of Richard Nixon was, by some lights, the most consequential event in terms of producing a Carter victory. I also think, as Stefan described earlier, and as you talked about, the sort of the atmosphere in the country really wanted a source of change, a new beginning. And, you know, he brought this kind of breath of fresh air. And he talks a lot about American values, and the previous administration seemed to at least trample on some of those values. And I think that also contributed to his success. And, of course, Ford made that very big foreign policy blunder in the debate over Eastern Europe.
Yes.
He said Poland was not part of the Eastern Bloc orbit? Or,
yes, that's right.
Something
to
that effect.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dean Borg, I know after Jimmy Carter became president, you went to Washington and happened to go to or sought out a Sunday school that Jimmy Carter taught for decades.
Yes. I don't know why I was in Washington. It was over a weekend, I know, that probably on some other responsibility, and I happened to be on a weekend. I knew that Jimmy Carter was noted for teaching a Sunday school class, so I sought it out. It was a First Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., about 9 blocks north of the White House. And as I walked into the church that morning, it was walking into any church. There was no security or anything like that. And I walked up to an information table as I walked in the door and asked about President Carter's class, and they said it's upstairs in the balcony. And so
no security check, nothing.
No,
just walked
no,
right up the door,
no.
Right up the chest stairs.
And so walked upstairs, and yes, I sat down among maybe 30 other people in that balcony, and President Carter taught the class.
Mm-hmm. You know, Can I just make a quick observation? Yes. What Gerald Ford actually said was there is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. And the moderator of that debate, Max Frankel, who was with the New York Times, sort of was astonished. And he said, you know, I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said, you mean that the Soviet Union does not use Eastern Europe for its own sphere of influence? And Ford, instead of saying, no, that's not what I meant, insisted that he was right, that there was no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. The lesson? What's the lesson? The lesson is that if you have a problem where you glitched something, it is much better for you to say, no, that's not what I meant. It came out of my mouth that way, but that's not what I meant. Instead of saying, well, I've got to, you know, insist that what I said was right. I can't admit that I said something wrong. And I think other candidates for the presidency ought to learn a lesson from that. You know, people will always forgive you and say, well, of course, we all make some mistake, you know. But he insisted that that was an accurate statement. And, of course, Poland and Romania and other countries were completely in the Soviet sphere of influence. So,
but it wasn't Jimmy Carter's demeanor to gloat over that in that debate.
That's right.
He didn't make any correction. He let it go on and let the consequences fall against Gerald Ford.
Right. Which was smart. But, you know, let the tree fall on its own. You know, if it's already going over, you don't need to get out a chainsaw, right?
It's interesting to think about that debate happening in a modern media environment when there would have been a pounce, and of course your candidate would have been very media savvy and trained up to take advantage of such situations.
That's right.
Dean, you wanted to add something.
Well, I was going to say, back to the church service, and later on you talked about security. As the worship service began, the Sunday school hour was over. Then, during the church service, a man stood up, a demonstrator stood up during the church service, and you knew that there was security there because immediately, I mean, he was talking about something that he objected to in foreign policy or whatever it was, and security immediately grabbed that man from the congregation and escorted him outside.
Very, very interesting. We're going to continue our discussion after a short break. Dean Borg, thank you for being with us, IPTV host of Iowa Press, with your remembrances of Jimmy Carter on Iowa Press back in the mid-1970s, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Dean, thanks for coming in. When we come back, Stefan Schmidt and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University will be with us and continue our conversation as we get into the Carter years, the presidency. We'll ask on the domestic front what President Carter faced during his 4 years, 1977 to 1981, on the economic front as well as on the foreign policy front. Join our conversation, your experience, your reflection from the Carter years, 1-866-780-9100. Before we go to this break, let's listen to a campaign song from 1976. Perhaps you remember this from the Jimmy Carter campaign. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
I heard a young man speaking out just the other day. I stopped just to listen to what he had to say. He spoke straight and simple. By that I was impressed, he said. Once and for all, why not the best? Said his name was Jimmy Carter, and he was running for president. And it laid out a plan of action, made a lot of sense. He talked about the government and how it used to be for you and me. That's the way it ought to be. Right now, once and for all, why not the best?
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, taking a break from our coverage of the 2016 presidential race to look back at the national political climate in our nation, in our state, some 40 years ago, a climate that led to the election of Jimmy Carter as president. He served as president from 1977 to 1981, awarded the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize for his work with the Carter Center. We hope to talk about that a little bit later. A man raised in rural Georgia put himself out there as a peanut farmer, defeated incumbent President Gerald Ford in a very close election in 1976, ran as an outsider, promising truth in government in the wake of the Watergate scandal. And we're asking for your input, your remembrances, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Still with us this hour, Jim McCormick and Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. Before we do get some callers in here, let's talk about the domestic and foreign policy fronts for this president. Stephen, can you talk about the domestic issues, so what Carter faced during his 4 years?
Sure. He was unfortunate in catching a kind of downward spiral of the world economy, including the U.S. Energy prices were spiking. There was something that was called stagflation, which was stagnation of the economy at the same time that prices were going up, which is a devastating and extremely difficult challenge to face. And so he tried to essentially address those. He talked about competent and compassionate government. He managed to some extent to make some headway with the unemployment, got the deficit down somewhat because the deficit was out of control. But really the momentum of all those forces, including very high interest rates, very large unemployment, and inflation, were just... let's just say too much. Mm-hmm. The thing that we should remember is that Jimmy Carter was also in those short 4 years a huge force in American national politics. He created the Department of Education. He created the Department of Energy, which the Republicans now would like to dismantle most of those in the contemporary period. So Jimmy Carter, you know, probably isn't very happy about that. Mm-hmm. And he also established essentially what would be a national energy policy, which hadn't really been there before, which may in fact be helping us in the period after Carter in having the federal government play a role in promoting energy in the various different ways that it has done ever since then.
Right, and we had conservation enter our vocabulary at this time, not just using energy, but conserving it. And we had a president, my image of President Carter, in a sweater in front of a fireplace saying, you know, turn that thermostat down in the winter and put on a sweater, right? On the foreign policy front, Jim McCormick, tell us what did President Carter face during those years, 77 through 81, in terms of foreign policy, perhaps starting with his major accomplishment, the Camp David Accords?
Sure. I mean, he came to office really determined to take a different tack than the previous administration of Nixon and Ford, which had focused basically on detente and stability among the great powers. I remember him saying on the campaign trail that he wanted a foreign policy as good and as decent as the American people. He really wanted to infuse American values back into foreign policy. And so, you know, the Camp David Accords fits into this kind of model, but he started out, of course, with his emphasis on global human rights. Not that that was unfamiliar to American experience in the past, but he really rejuvenated it and gave it a high profile, particularly in his first year and a half, saying that policy would be largely determined on the way that countries or states treat their citizens. And, of course, resolving the Middle East dispute fit nicely into resolving kind of human rights issues that existed in that area. I think the Camp David Accords has to be identified as his major foreign policy success. Certainly at the time, it was attacked actually by a lot of different sides. But what he did was to get the parties together, the Egyptians and the Israelis, to sign a peace treaty, of course, that has held since then. He wasn't successful on the other part of the Camp David Accords, and that is to really deal with the question of the West Bank and the other territories from the Six-Day War that had been in dispute between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But I do think that he also changed the direction of American foreign policy because he started to move and to recognize Palestinian rights. It was going to be later Reagan that actually made that absolute step. But he initiated it by talking, even as he visited the Middle East, talking about Palestinian rights.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Jimmy Carter after signing the Camp David Accords, September 17th, 1978. He remarked that the Accords were an achievement none thought possible a year ago or even a month ago.
There are still great difficulties that remain and many hard issues to be settled. The questions that have brought warfare and bitterness to the Middle East for the last 30 years will not be settled overnight. But we should all recognize the substantial achievements that have been made. One of the agreements that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin are signing tonight is entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
Okay, Jimmy Carter in 1978 in September, upon signing the historic Camp David Accords. Of course, Middle East problems still with us, but that was a significant step toward peace recognized as...
It was very interesting, if I can just jump
sure.
In terms of, you know, they called the Camp David by the summer of 78, of course. It seems to me that the euphoria over Sadat's visit to Menachem Begin in Israel sort of had worn off and the peace process was really frayed. And Carter had the insight and the wisdom to call both of those leaders to Camp David. And, you know, they were there. It's kind of reminiscent of an earlier period. They were there for 13 days. And they almost broke down those negotiations. And the description that Carter lays out in his autobiography of moving from cabin to cabin because they had no interaction with one another, he was truly the mediator, the intermediary, I should say, between the two parties because he went from cabin to cabin to negotiate the Camp David Accord. So it was a remarkable sort of personal diplomacy as well as American diplomacy at its best.
Right. And Ben, could I add that it was probably the high point of Jimmy Carter's administration,
right,
especially in terms of foreign policy.
Because
right. after that, everything went south.
Right.
And you may want to talk about that as well.
Yes, we do. And we've got just over 10 minutes left. We've got a lot of callers. I don't know how many. We'll try to get as many as possible on the air. But we do want to talk about the low end of the presidency happened toward the end. A series of big problems. The 1979 energy crisis. We remember the Three Mile Island nuclear accident happened at this time. A partial nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan on his clock. In response, Carter ending detente, escalating the Cold War, that international boycott of the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow. But first and foremost, we remember a low point of the Iranian hostage crisis, 52 U.S. citizens held hostage for 444 days, only released actually almost moments after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as president. Let's listen to Carter making these comments just after 7 days after the group of student revolutionaries in Iran seized the U.S. embassy. These are comments from President Carter, November 11th, 1979.
No one should underestimate the resolve of the American government and the American people in this matter. It is necessary to eliminate any suggestion that economic pressures can weaken our stand on basic issues of principle. Our position must be clear. I am ordering that we discontinue purchasing of any oil from Iran for delivery to this country.
Okay, the embargo announced there. To fast forward there later, there was in April of 1980, here's President Carter at a press conference after a failed mission to rescue the hostages held in Iran. It was codenamed Desert One, I believe, resulted in 8 dead U.S. servicemen and no rescue.
It was my responsibility as president to launch this mission. It was my responsibility to terminate the mission when it ended.
This was a decision that was shared completely by the field commander in charge of the rescue team and by the officer in charge of the overall force that was involved in the rescue effort. There is a deeper failure than that of incomplete success.
Okay, President Carter there, all shocked at the failed attempt to rescue the hostages. Jim and Stefan, was this a crucial moment? Had those hostages at least had some sort of success instead of complete defeat in the desert in Iran? Could it have been a different story? Could there have been a second Carter term?
I think so. I think that, you look at public opinion polling during the campaign between Reagan and Carter in 1980. And one of the things that poll taken really sort of the weekend before the election showed that one of the things that the public had really lost confidence in really in terms of foreign policy, even if the public didn't know all the details of this, the failure to get those hostages back. And, what I like to talk about to make the point is, America Held Hostage was an ABC program that started. Its successor program was Nightline. But they went on for several days. They had America Held Hostage Day 1, America Held Hostage Day 25. And I think that that constant kind of reinforcement that the Americans seemed helpless and the American government seemed helpless, obviously played on the psyche of Americans in terms of the reelection. So if there had been the release of the hostages, the mission, though, was so complex. I mean, you talked about Desert One. There was a Desert Two, and then they had to get into Tehran. It was really going to be very, very dicey of whether there would be a success of that mission. I mean, obviously, the commanders and so said that they could carry it off. But if you read the details of the proposed mission, I'm just wondering how many they could have rescued and how many lives might have been lost in any event.
Mm-hmm. But honestly, let's be fair here. Carter has admitted he interfered and cut down the force that was to go in. He reduced the number of helicopters. He wanted to go in with as little military force as possible, not as much. And that was a pattern that was typical, in a sense, of Carter, because he really didn't like the idea of using the U.S. armed forces to conduct American foreign policy. And his staff, especially his human rights staff in the White House, were very, very nice people. They were very much oriented towards human rights, but they didn't have a clue what the real world was like. They were very naive people.
Well, I would agree with you, Stefan, except until what happened with the invasion of Afghanistan and after the hostage crisis, because what turns out is that President Carter proposed a huge increase in defense spending. I mean, Reagan usually gets credit for upping defense spending if when he took office. But the plan proposed by Carter in his last year really turned policy around for his administration to a much more what I would envision as a Cold War kind of approach. Right. So obviously there had been a change, and he of course enunciated the Carter Doctrine in his State of the Union address in 1980, saying that if there was an invasion of the Middle East by any of these countries, obviously meaning the Soviet Union,
right,
there would be an American response. And that was a language really going back to the heart of the Cold War. So I think that there was a real pivot, if we could use that modern-day term, in terms of the Carter approach to foreign policy during his last year in office.
And it was called too little too late is what they referred to it as.
With just a few minutes left in the hour, remembering the Carter presidency, and we hope to get to a couple minutes at least to comment on all the great things that President Carter did after his presidency. Evan is on the line in Des Moines. I'll have to please ask you to make it brief. Evan, your comment?
Yes, we should keep in mind that Jimmy Carter invented running extensively in Iowa as through to the presidency. We may have him to thank for all these candidates crisscrossing the state.
Right. It really cemented, we were making that point earlier, cemented the Iowa caucuses. Iowa is important because it's first. It's not first because it's important, is the way I've heard it expressed.
So here's a man of complete integrity and faith who becomes the largest political leader, and he's not very good at it. A few minutes ago, there was a question about how the evangelical movement became so conservative, and Randall Balmer talks about that in his biography of Jimmy Carter. I also wanted to comment on something Ted Kennedy said about Carter's approach to legislation. He said, even when I agree with what he's trying to do, he still doesn't know how to do it. So,
okay, Evan, we have to go short of time. Thank you for your comments from Des Moines. Carter, highly active after leaving the White House. Many consider that he accomplished more in his post-presidency work than during the presidency in a certain sort of way. Mm-hmm. Set up the Carter Center in 1982, his base for advancing human rights. Also traveled extensively to conduct peace negotiations observe elections. The Carter Center observing 100 elections in 38 countries. Let's listen to this comment. Carter making these comments in a press conference about his cancer diagnosis. He was asked what goals he had before he died.
I would like to see guinea worm completely eradicated before I die. I'd like for the last guinea worm to die before I do. I think right now we have 11 cases. We started out with 3.6 million cases. And I think we have 2 cases in South Sudan and 1 case in Ethiopia and 1 case in Mali and 7 cases in Chad. That's all the guinea worms in the world. And we know where all of them are. So I would say that would be my top priority.
Okay. President Carter, a real achievement, the guinea worm. Their eradication, advancing disease prevention in the world. Quick words from you, Stefan and Jim, about his post-presidency.
Well, I mean, he's been remarkable, energetic, written books, travels all over the world, has tried to make elections cleaner, and is certainly a shining example for any president who could do so much because they have, you know, so much influence and connections. And, you know, some choose to go and start, you know, paintings of their family and other things. And Jimmy Carter chose to become a world leader to make life better for a lot of people. And I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, I think I would agree wholeheartedly with Stefan. The idea of a 90-year-old individual going and working, building houses, you know, around the world where Habitat Humanity. I mean, really shows the kind of commitment. And, you know, he is obviously a man of deep faith as well. And and that press conference last week made it clear, even as he was facing, you know, cancer and so on. He just is, in that sense, is really a remarkable individual. You mentioned earlier that he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 and, you know, very, very worthy recipient of that for his work, not only advancing democracy, but we haven't talked very much, but he was very concerned in his presidency with advancing human rights. And he had actually some successes in terms of, you know, Southern Africa, for example, and the movement towards freeing Namibia and moving ultimately Zimbabwe as well and South Africa eventually.
Jimmy Carter, very active as a world leader. Let's bring it back home here. He was vigorously opposed, as we end this hour in the last minute or two, opposed to the Supreme Court's decision, Citizens United versus the FEC, to strike down the McCain-Feingold limits on campaign spending by corporations and unions, saying that America is no longer a functioning democracy. This is just a short time ago, July of 2015. He now says it's a system of unlimited political bribery. Let's listen to him make this comment on a radio show.
It violates the essence of what made America a great country in its political system. Now it's just an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery being the essence of getting the nominations for president or the elected president. And the same thing applies to governors and U.S. senators and Congress members. So now we've just seen a complete subversion of our political system as a payoff to major contributors who want and expect and sometimes get favors for themselves after the election's over.
Okay, yeah. Former President Carter, what could be more harsh about our system, Jim and Stefan?
Yeah, he's wrong, of course, because...
Why is he wrong?
Look, you know, he doesn't want to admit that for many, many, many decades, labor unions dictated the Democratic Party's agenda. I mean, labor was the single most important, powerful constituency. They gave a lot of money. They were the ones who had the equivalent of political action committees. And the Republican Party was always the party of wealthy industrialists. I mean, the party of Lincoln was the exception. And so money has always played an enormous role in American politics. It was never just individuals, you know, teachers, plumbers, and homemakers who participated. And what we have now is lots more money, but everybody has a lot of money. So there's a sort of mutually assured destruction going on because everybody has a lot of money.
I'm comforted by mutual assured destruction. The few seconds that are left, Jim McCormick, do you have an agreement or a disagreement with what Stefan just said?
I think Stefan has, for effect, overstated the the impact. I would agree more with Jimmy Carter. I think there's a real danger to democracy, and I think, you know, that is being tapped in the American public presently. That there's a concern that people are left out of it, and what he did in 1976, we're hearing once again today.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Thank you so much for remembering with us the presidency of Jimmy Carter.
Unbelievable.
All right. You guys are going to continue to have your discussion. We have to end this hour here on Iowa Public Radio. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Thanks to Sean McClain in Ames. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.